A very good evening to you all. You're listening to Nick M on Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. I've had a little bit of trouble getting to work with the mics and everything tonight, but it seems to be working all right now. I've got a great show for you this evening. We're going to be talking with Mike the Money Man, or at least it's a recording that was made at the Truth Juice Summer Gathering, which means those of you that have become a bit of a fan of my sound effects are going to get to hear the steam train passing backwards and forwards, a bit of rain and a bit of flapping of tentage. And some chatting in the background. Later on in the show, I hope to bring you a conversation I had with the Spaniard from White Rabbit Education whilst we were sharing some space at the Sunrise celebration down in Somerset. But right now, I'm going to move straight on with Mike the Money Man, give you a chance to hear what this lovely man's got to say. He's going to give us a bit of a talk. We'll have a bit of a conversation about the illusion that is money. Truth Juice Gathering had several people speaking at it. Mike was one of them. I've not come across him before, but turned out to be a very interesting person. So here we go. Here's Mike the Money Man at the Truth Juice Summer Gathering.
So here we are again. This is Nick M for the Dr. Rock radio show at the 2011 Truth Juice Gathering. I've got with me this time, I've got Mike the Money Man, who did a fantastic presentation yesterday revealing the illusion of money. So we've got a bit of time to talk, Mike. What do you think is the key point people would really need to know about our money?
Our money, well, it's really about our money system, which is pretty much the same thing as our money as far as I'm concerned, which is that it is a big con.
Yep.
The current system that we have in place, it's grown out of true economy, but over the years, over the centuries, it's been quietly and systematically distorted from its true purpose, which is to allow us as individual citizens, as individual human beings, to trade with each other, to exchange what we're good at for what we need, to help enrich each other's lives.
So how were things originally run? To that end, how was it before it changed?
You go back say 5-10,000 years BC. Interestingly enough, you go back to say 3-4,000 BC, and you start to see writing. The first recordable writing is all about keeping accounts. Who's brought the grain in? Who's brought it into store, etc., etc. It's all about tracking stuff.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's what an economy is. It's about tracking each other's stuff, isn't it? I mean, you've got a choice. You can either give your stuff away, you can keep it for yourself, or you can trade it for other people's stuff that you would be better, you know, you'd rather have than the extra stuff that you've got. That's the essence of an economy.
Did money come before writing, do we think?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, a lot of my research has been, it's obviously been observing, but a lot of it is kind of like practical experience of me trying to deal with the system.
And I know that in Sumer, you see, they came up with a whole load of little tokens. I don't know whether you've seen them, and some of them were tetrahedral, some of them were spherical, some of them were just round like coins, and some of them were like half a tetrahedron or half a sphere.
Right, which would obviously be worth half of a full tetrahedron.
That's right, and these were tokens. They were tokens representing things. They seem to have come before cuneiform, because we've also found these things called bullae, which are about the size of like a large cricket ball. They're made out of clay or the mud, the kind of mud they use for doing everything over there. And they devised the system of putting all these little tokens inside the clay ball and giving it to the guy who was going to deliver the stuff. So the guy that was delivering the stuff couldn't see what tokens were in there.
Right.
We found several full ones, which means that we were beginning to see trust and faith, because people would take delivery of the stuff, the sheep, the goats, the bread, whatever, slaves, whatever it was, and somehow they wouldn't bother looking into the bullae to make sure that the tokens matched the delivery.
Right.
You see? And what I think happened is that in Sumer, these tokens, and I think the oldest tokens we've got are off the eastern seaboard of... Excellent, thank you. Off the eastern seaboard of Europe, and it's thought they might be 30,000 years old. Now, I believe that the cuneiform writing, that, as you correctly say, it's nearly all to do with accounting at the beginning, probably developed from the tokens. They suddenly realised that we don't have to send the tokens, we can send some marks on a clay tablet.
Right. interesting idea. Yeah, because I mean, in one sense, writing is it's all about shorthand for real things. So, you know, the alphabets are all slimmed down pictographs. But I'm intrigued by this idea of the geometrical forms, because it reminds me of the whole relationship of the various Platonic solids, which all have different mathematical relationships to each other because they sit inside each other. So some are bigger than others, and some are smaller within. And that would have defined the relative value of the relative tokens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's an interesting...
Apparently, actually, weights and measures used to be related to the size of the planet Earth. I can't remember the details, but I remember reading from a really great source that the pint of beer that was being served in Elizabethan times was as close to a true pint, closer than nowadays, and that the size of a pint is somehow related to the ancients' knowledge of the size and obliquity of the Earth.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Because I come at that from a slightly different angle, because I'm aware, for example, that in England, in the UK, we used to have our imperial measure, didn't we? And when we went over to metric, now metric is a system that was, as far as I can tell, arbitrarily introduced by Napoleon, and doesn't really have any relationship to anything tangible. It's an abstract system.
They tried to, but got it wrong, I think. That was
right.
The point. They tried to relate it to one of the great circles on the Earth, but their calculations were incorrect. The Sumerians were closer.
Yeah, right, okay. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff we've been trying to reinvent over the last couple of thousand years.
Yeah.
But the English system, the system of the British Isles, the imperial system, was all based on different proportions of the human body. So, you know, your inch is your finger, and you've got, I think, span is at a foot or six inches.
Thumb to little finger there.
Yeah, if you've got the elbow to tip of the finger.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got all these different. And the proportionality between these different aspects of the human body, which then extend out into furlongs. I mean, was an acre as much a land as a man could plough in a day with an oxen? So they all relate to real things that you can identify with.
Apparently the Chinese did really well at that. They had a set of bells that were given weights and a given tuning. And a given size, and they were completely related. So it was a set of weights and measures, and for solid, liquid.
So there's a sense.
Now,
which...
what we're talking about, isn't it? What we're talking about is things being directly related to real life.
Yes, and we're also talking about an extension of the inherent proportionality that exists in the real world, nature, the human being, the universe, the cosmos.
So where did we start going wrong? When did we lose this concept?
When the concept of value, or the notion of value, was decoupled from that reality, and became an abstract system.
When do you reckon that happened?
Well, I suppose it probably happened the first time some official decided to become corrupt. You know, because it's a little kind of like a bubble universe, isn't it? You pinch a little space off and you create an abstraction in it, and you give it value, and you convince other people it has value.
And it was like that, wasn't it? It was stolen a bit at a time from us.
Yes.
So what was their first move? What do you reckon, when it became corrupt enough for it to become noticeable on say, the macroeconomic scale, what was the first move that started turning cash, if you like, into money?
Well, I can't say when the first one was, but I mean, it's pretty evident if you look at English history. I mean, there was a time when people weren't taxed. Well, they were only taxed in time of war to fill the treasury, because it's pretty expensive if your ruler or your king wants to mount a war. He's got to raise some taxes, and that was the thing, wasn't it? We were free men, we were free, but we were subject to a lord who, under certain circumstances, could call upon our services, you know, to go out and try and trash the French again, or whatever it was.
I shall not kill unless it's in considerable quantity and somewhere not close to home.
Yes. So you know, you would have occasional tax raising, but that kind of slipped into, and I can't forget exactly, but probably around
Napoleon.
The 16th century, became a permanent fixture So, you know, with a Bank of England and a permanent tax-raising levy on, and of course now it's become, inverted commas, normal. We just accept it. Because, hey, that's the way it is, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to introduce de-reform, if you like, or deconstruct something and introduce a parallel system, you do it on the frog in the boiling water pot. Yeah, you don't introduce the whole lot first. You don't go along to all your free people and say, hey, we're going to introduce a rigid tax system that will take pretty much everything you've got to just keep, because you're going to revolt. But you don't want people revolting at that stage, because they'll win.
Yes.
So you just do it gradually.
And it's a ratchet, isn't it? So the pressure can be applied and applied and applied until the populace resists a bit, and then it's like those ratchet spanners. You can move it backwards, but the ratchet itself stays where it is.
Yes.
So when the pressure's still applied, it's gone nowhere. It's still tweaking.
It's like a valve system. Yeah. It's like a fish hook. Yeah. You can push it in, but you can't take it out again.
Yeah.
And of course, the English as a corporate nation have become incredibly good at this, divide and rule. So we have this thing, you know, this objectivity. There's always two sides in an objective debate, isn't there? There's the genetic modification of crops on the one hand, there's free organic systems on the other. Well, in an objective debate where you're being rational, surely you have to consider both points of view. If you're being fair, surely you have to come to some kind of compromise. Oh, well, you know, maybe the compromise is, well, we'll just have 5% contamination of natural seed stock by GM crops. That seems reasonable. It's only 5%. You're keeping 95% of the argument on your side of the scale. Oh, 5 years down the line, oh, well, you know, we're having a debate again. Well, we need to move it because, you know, 5% is the new zero. So you want to keep it rolled back. You're being unreasonable. Oh, no, we must, you know, it's your nice BBC Radio 4 civilised debate, you know, one from either side. Oh, but how about challenging the whole thing? Because this has become a bit abstract, hasn't it? Because once you contaminate natural seed, it's contaminated forever. So we're not talking the same language here. You know, something's being done. It's a bit of it's a ratchet effect. So
yeah.
This is what happens. This is what is quietly imposed upon our psyche
and
our souls.
And the management system in this country is the Bank of England, and in America it's the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
And the Bank of England is no more a national bank, I suppose, than the Federal Reserve is either federal or a reserve. As Montaigne would say.
And of course, the American.
So, what is the bank? For people who don't know, what is our Bank of England?
What is our Bank of England? I know what the Federal Reserve is. Federal Reserve is a private club. It's a private consortium of bankers who set up the Federal Reserve. I mean, apparently, and I, from what I've read and from the research has done so far. There was kind of an interesting tale behind that, because the two presidential candidates in the appropriate American presidential election at the time, and I think it's going back probably to the beginning, the 20th century, were both approached by these private banking families to set this Federal Reserve up, and they both said no way. Mm-hmm. And so they set up their own straw man candidate. Who would sign that off when he got in, and that straw man candidate was Woodrow Wilson,
right?
Who
yeah.
was also responsible then for signing for being influential in signing the armistice with Germany after the First World War, dumping all the responsibility for the war and the reparations on Germany, which of course they could never pay, which led to the hyperinflation, the collapse of their economy, and created right conditions for the fascist government of Hitler to rise up.
And also provided a kind of counterpoint, if you like, to the collapse that was being engineered in America at the same time.
Absolutely. And so so it's pretty evident, just from looking at that, that Woodrow Wilson was not exactly the brightest, sharpest tool in the box, or the brightest light in the room.
Puppet can't choose what he writes.
No. So it's a little bit of sleight of hand here.
I think the same thing has happened in England. I remember being told that the old lady of Threadneedle Street is actually a corporation of a dozen or so individuals.
Well, I mean, I could well believe this. I mean, because I also learn recently, and anybody can go and check this out, that the city of London, which is effectively a sovereign state, has a reminder. I think he's called the reminder. He sits behind the Speaker's chair in the House of Parliament to remind the Speaker. This is an appointee of the City of London, okay, whose job it is to sit behind the Speaker's chair and remind him. Now, what he reminds him of, well, that's anybody's guess, isn't it? That's speculation. But as he is the representative of the City of London, sitting behind the Speaker of the House of Commons, whose job it is to keep and maintain order amongst the members, looks like a little back door to me.
That's it. And just to be clear, when we say that the City of London is a separate state, it operates in a completely different legislative framework from the rest of the United Kingdom or England. And that is true also of Washington and the Vatican, I believe.
Yes, well, of course, the Vatican is a separate state, mm-hmm. Of course. Yes, absolutely.
So there you go. We've got a bunch of private individuals who gain for themselves the monopoly right to print, as Mike Watanian would say, to print the evidence of our promissory obligations to each other. That's what they do. Is they, in the old days, they would have printed notes, and now they simply generate noughts on computers. And
absolutely. Yes.
So how does it work? What are they doing to us in this process?
Well, I mean, we're talking about fractional reserve banking, aren't we? Which is the ability to lend out more money than you actually have in your bank vaults.
And we say it's borrowed into existence in the first place.
It's
so
borrowed
what
into
do we
existence.
Mean by that?
Or well, loaned into existence.
You explain the sort of manoeuvres that bring actual cash.
Well, the general principle is that at any given time, with any resource, you know, you don't have 100% call on it. You've got a proportional call on it. So this is true of money as well. So if somebody goes to a bank and they deposit, say, £100 in the bank, and they go off, they don't need it now, that's why they wouldn't put it in the bank. Some stage they'll come back and they'll make a call on it. They want it back, or they want part of it back. So there's a calculation made that at any given time, only 10% of the money that's actually deposited will be required to be taken back out. So they've got 90% of the money, which, you know, they pretty much will be sitting in there forever. So why not lend it out? So they lend it out. And, you know, so they lend £90 to the next guy who comes along. What's he going to do with it? Stick it in the bank until he needs it. So suddenly that £100 has turned into £190 in that bank vault. And they can lend.
And how far have they got now? How far have they managed to extend, say, £100, do you think?
Well, I mean, if you take it down just a few courses in the loop, you know, if you take it down, I think nine loops, you get sort of £600-700. So, because you've got 90% of the 90, which is 81, and 90% of the 81.
So if we say that's the case, then what are they holding 90% of?
They're holding 90% of our goodwill.
Cracking.
Yeah. Now, that's fairly conventional economics. That's been going on for quite a long time, and to some degree it does have some basis in reality, bearing in mind that we were talking about the difference between, you know, things which relate to real proportions and things which have been invented. In recent times, especially since market deregulation, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were prime movers in that, we have had a complete separation of the creation of money from anything real.
You showed a very interesting graph yesterday of that happening, didn't you?
Yes.
Can you describe the graph?
Well, it was basically a graph taken from Chris Martinson's presentation, The Crash Course, which showed that over the course of the 20th century, typical household debt in America, with the exception of a spike around the time of the Great First War and the Great Depression, had pretty much stayed the same until the early 70s, at which time it started to shoot up, and it's now about 300-400% above that baseline from the early 70s. And the key thing that happened to cause that was the decoupling of the dollar from the gold standard.
So that was the moment at which the trying to measure something really real, as in the English pint of beer or the Chinese bowls, that's the point at which at last it was finally eroded completely.
Completely eroded, and the dollar became pinned to the dollar. Well, that's a good one, isn't it?
How do they get away with that, do you think?
Well, it's by most people not knowing or understanding the nature of what's happening.
What do you think the result of people finding out might be?
Well, they might be a little bit upset, might be a bit angry, might be a bit distressed, they might not care, so what? It's too complex for me. What's he going to do me? What are the consequences for me? I don't know, it's pretty abstract.
So what are the consequences for us of the decoupling of money from anything real?
Well, the consequences for us over the last 30 years has been that the value of money has increased. Money as a commodity, i.e. is something that you could buy and sell in its own right, another name of which is usury, has become completely unregulated by anything that relates to everyday earthy reality. So that you can buy and sell financial products, which basically means, because of course, going back to the bank thing, when these guys are putting in their money, they're getting an interest for that. Thank you very much. We'll give you something for putting your money in our bank. We'll give you an interest. We'll give you, say, I don't know, 3% interest on the money, the deposit. But when we lend it out, we'll charge interest. Look, for the privilege of borrowing this money off us, which we have created, we have loaned into existence, we're going to charge you 5% or 6%.
So that means
there's a difference.
Yes.
Of 3%. Which is the bank's profit, which is how it makes its real money.
And when we say loaned into existence, we mean that somebody wants to buy something and they come to the... They say they want to buy, like, I don't know, a boat.
Yeah.
They want to buy a boat and they come to the bank and they say, I want to buy a boat, lend me the money. And what the bank do at that point, we're saying, is because there is a loan required, the bank creates the money, which is simply a matter of writing a cheque on itself. And we have the evidence of that now, don't we? The banks have written that down.
Quantitative easing.
They simply take that money and they give it to the guy who built the boat and they say, away you go, there's your money. And then they get to charge the person who wants to buy the boat the interest and effectively the principal over time. They get the whole lot back off them.
And we can all understand what that is, because that's a traditional mortgage on a house. You take out your loan, you pay back the interest, say it's 180,000 these days on a typical house. You pay back the 180,000 over the course of your life, but you also pay all the interest. And of course the interest is also compounded as well. Now that would be bad enough in itself, as a form of obliging us to service somebody else through the contract we have made with them. To have the privilege of being able to live in a house. But it gets even worse or better or scarier depending on your perspective. When money becomes a product in itself, not related to houses or food or any actual tangible useful assets, becomes a thing in itself where you buy and sell money, which is what these clever wide boys in the city do with their clever financial products and their clever schemes for borrowing money here, buying some futures here, selling them, repackaging them, selling them on at a profit, paying back the loan. You know, where's that come from? Where's the added value there? The only added value is in an abstraction, which is within money itself. It's a nominal computer fiction.
Smoke and mirrors.
Completely. Fiction. But, you see, it's not as if these guys don't know that. I mean, they're the ones that are writing the clever computer programs and the algorithms to work all this out. Of course they know it. So they're not going to keep hold of money because it's got no value anymore. It's just related to the only value it has is itself.
So what are they doing?
They're investing it. They're buying land and property and durable goods and paintings and anything that's got real value. So they're buying the land. They're buying the buildings.
And we see, therefore, that things are transferring from hand to hand such that people that need money have to get rid of their stuff.
Yes.
So the wealth is continuing. In fact, one of the things that governments have infallibly done is increase the distance between the rich and the poor.
Yeah.
And increase the number of poor people relative to the number of rich.
Well, I'd contest that ever so slightly.
Yeah.
I'd say the job of government is to make sure that the imbalance between the richest and the poorest, or the majority of the richest, the not quite richest and the not quite poorest, does not grow so great that the poorest give up all hope. Because once hope is gone and you're no longer buying into the system, you're free to think of alternatives. So their job is to create the illusion that there is social mobility.
Okay, this brings us really usefully to the point of solution, because we can ask a couple of questions here. I can ask a couple of questions, or two parts. The first is, having got to this particular point, we've now got practically 0% interest rates, which Mr. Montagna tells us quite realistically is because they can no longer, the debt is now so absolutely vast that not even they, with all their sleight of hands, can do any more. And in Mike Montagna's point, it means the point of collapse has been reached. So, from that point, given, as you say, the government's job is to try and make it so the poor don't become so poor that they notice, what can they possibly be expected to do to maintain that position at this point?
I don't think they're even pretending anymore. I mean, if you go back to, say, the 90s or the 80s, and you remember political rhetoric, it was always couched with things like fairness and honesty, and we are an honourable nation, and we are doing this for the good of all, blah, blah, blah. But what George Bush and Tony Blair and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and that bunch of politicians did was they actually proved and demonstrated that you could actually say what you were doing and get away with it. You know? So even in England, even under the John Major government, some minister made some huge gaffe or his hypocrisy was exposed. I'm thinking of things like Back to Basics, you know, our moral integrity, it's all the fault of single young mothers, etc. Next thing you know, it's all blowing up in their faces, their infidelities, their... Now, I'm not making any moral judgments here. They made the moral judgments, and they were proved to be hypocrites, and they resigned. But we move forward, track forward to the Blair era, and thanks to our good ex-leader Tony Blair, you no longer have to resign when you're proved to be a hypocrite. You just face it down and you carry on business as usual. So we've entered into a new era where you can face it down. It doesn't matter who thinks you're a hypocrite or a crook, because, hey, guess what? You've got the power now.
Yeah.
And so it's all blatant. It's all out in the open. Everybody knows that the banks, who've suffered these tremendous losses because, you know, some of their major contracts, like the subprime mortgage products, have all collapsed. They've been bailed out by the people. We know that their debts have suddenly become our debts. And there's no pretense that it's otherwise.
Given that they've appropriated everything we've ever done, collateralised it into their own ownership and charged us interest on it, how are they possibly sustained? The scale of the problem must be catastrophically huge for them to be sustaining a loss under those circumstances. Are we sure they're really sustaining a loss?
Well, I think there's a more interesting question.
Which would be...
Given the fact that they're actually saying, "Hey, guess what? We're conning you. We're robbing you blind. These smart gamblers, we're putting their debts on you. It's your debt now. It's our debt. We have to pay it off by cutting our schools, our hospitals, everything that holds the infrastructure of our society together. That all has to go, right? It's a small price to pay. And by the way, what's being proposed at the moment is only a tiny fraction of our inverted commas debt." Somehow, we still buy into it. We still collectively say, okay, well, that's what we have to do. So they've reached the point where they're saying, well, look, we're robbing you blind, but we know you're not going to do anything about it. What can you do?
And that's because we've acquiesced.
Continue to believe that this system has value.
Yeah.
And it's when that belief goes...
We can start seeing that belief going. Well, for a start-off, if the situation as presented is as critical as it obviously is, the debt that is so massive that they're sustaining losses even having acquired everything throughout all the history, and the fact that we've got 0% interest rates suggesting that the point of collapse has already been passed. So, and people are noticing. You know, you had a lot of people in for your talk last night, and you're obviously not the only one that's talking about it, although I really like your take on it. So it brings us to the point where it has already, we might as well say it has already gone tits up. Let's just say that the money has stopped working. Enough people have realised that it's no longer worth them doing the tax and all of the other things that we have to do to kind of keep ourselves, as they say, afloat. One of the things we like to do at tnsradio.ning.com is look for solutions. And I bet you've got the odd one.
Well, John Kenneth Galbraith, who used to be an advisor to President Kennedy, is quoted as once saying that the process by which money is created is so simple that the mind is repelled.
Brilliant. And the mind is repelled.
Because, and then he says, money is loaned into existence.
Galbraith, when did he say that?
I guess that would be in the early 60s. I think anybody could check that out, do the research.
They were sort of denying that. You know, if you look at the back of Veronica Chapman's book, where she has this kind of interaction with the Treasury saying, how is money made?
Mm.
Who decides how much of it? Who decides how it gets into circulation? And they parry with her.
Yeah.
Even when, on the third attempt, she goes, right, look, I'm going to suggest to you the answers to the questions I keep asking you. All I want you to do is either confirm or deny them. Broadly what we're saying here about money being created, loaned into existence.
Yeah.
So up until really, maybe only 5, 6, 7 years ago, they were resisting publishing that. And then recently we've seen these Treasury notes from the Treasury saying, when a loan is requested, the bank publishes, writes a check on itself and pays it to wherever. So it's really new, isn't it?
It is.
We take it for granted because of the people we meet, but it's new that.
I think there's something quite important here about the nature of human consciousness, because money is a reflection of something fundamental in the human being. It's a reflection of our goodwill. It's a promise to pay upon goods that we haven't yet delivered yet, even though we've received goods from you. Even though I've received goods from you, I haven't delivered, but I'm promising in the future I'll pay. And so we invest our goodwill into this system. Now, we invest our goodwill in the system, presumably, because we trust it. And we trust it, presumably, because we've had a little dialogue with ourselves at some stage to say, oh yeah, that makes sense. That's logical. That makes sense. But there's something about logic, and we touched on this earlier when we were talking about two points of view and only two points of view, and finding a nice balance between them. That's not what I would call logic. That's a sort of semantic dialectic. That's a sort of self-referential closed system. You know, that's like saying, you know, oh yeah, well the value of course there's a value to money. The value to money is the value of the money itself. Yeah, but what determines the value of the money? Well, it's the money, of course, stupid.
So you have, therefore, you have to have this third point in the triangle.
Exactly.
And that third point can be either the resolution or the perpetuation.
Exactly. But it's the point of choice. It's the point of choice where you step back and you look at it, you self-reflect on it, you say, hang on a minute, this doesn't work. And you either name it as the person, you know, you just quoted with the Treasury, you name it, you say, hey, this isn't what I see. Do you agree, yes or no? You pull a fast one, this is a tautology. Or you consent to still believe in it, but it's your choice. I mean, there was a day, was it 3 years ago, when the depositors of Northern Rock made a spontaneous choice that they no longer believed in the promise of that particular financial institution to pay what it owed. So they went to get their money out. Of course, every bank knows that the last thing they want is a run, because they don't have 100% of the funds, they only have 90%, or even less now, much less than 90%.
There's nothing there.
Virtually nothing there. Mm. And if that is known, the system is like the emperor with no clothes.
So at this point, you know, we hear tales of when Atlantis fell, millions of souls went down with it, but there's some people got out. You know, these myths that are totally global.
Yes.
Of tall, bearded, pale-skinned individuals arriving in reed boats or out of tunnels or what have you. So let's just they were the people who listened to the warnings, say of the informed classes, whatever, of Atlantis, and so they managed.
And the informed classes would not necessarily be the ruling classes.
Of course not, which brings us to our point now. What do we do, given that we now know we have a critical problem? Which is definitely going to cause us grief. What can we start thinking about doing? How can we start acting in some way to ameliorate at least what's going on?
Two things we need to get our head round. One is that when we hit a paradox, it's not a sign that it's a confusion. The paradox, i.e. that two things have to definitely be opposed to each other at all times, but actually can be just reflections of the same thing. It's a barrier our consciousness needs to go through. On the other side of that barrier, a paradox, lies, if you like, for want of a better term, the first steps on the road to enlightenment.
Resolution.
Yeah, because it's like, well, yeah, actually, I get that we can have night and day within the same system. I get that basically systems ebb and flow between two points. And I'm looking at the system itself, where both the opposites are essential to its ongoing governance and well-being. So, that's number one. So, if you're looking at paradoxes, if you're looking at two points, where are the two points? The one point is that in the current elite global system, money is loaned into existence, has no substantial reality beyond that. The counterpoint to that is that in a healthy economy, wealth, as opposed to money, there is a distinction, wealth is traded into existence.
This is Mike Montagna's point exactly, that as things are created, you publish the currency, you, the individual, write your promissory obligations between each other, and you put them into circulation, and as the thing gets used over an agreed rate, that gets retired at the other end.
Mm. Imagine the idea that money might die, consciously be traded out of existence over a period of time, because it tracks actual goods and services that are actually being created and offered to the community.
Yeah. Vin tells a really great story about, I can't quite remember the details, but a guy comes into a western town with $100 in his pocket, and he books a room, so he pays his $100 deposit. And the guy behind the bar, the guy at the hotel actually owes it to the guy at the bar for drinks and stuff. The guy at the bar owes $100 to the prostitute, you know, out the back. She owes $100 to the hotel man for the rent of the room. And eventually, so this $100 gets put in as a deposit for a room, gets paid by the guy in the hotel to the guy in the bar. He gives it to the prostitute gives it back to the guy in the hotel. The bloke turns up and says, I don't actually need the room, can I have my $100 back? And he leaves. And the $100 has paid off all of those debts and then just gone again.
Brilliant.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So one of the ways I would say that we can start doing this is to make sure that we don't let promissory notes like that leach from our own communities.
Absolutely.
If at all possible, you use it for settling debts amongst yourself.
Yeah.
Because there's got to be a sense in which, if you put it back in the bank, I bet you they won't put it out again until somebody's borrowed it.
Mm.
You know, they won't let it go. It's a bit like putting it out of the game.
Yeah, why would they?
Why would they?
Putting themselves out of business. Turkey's voting for Christmas.
And isn't that another link in the chain, in the kind of the hangman's noose, if you like?
Yeah.
Like every time you bank your cash, they're taking it off you and somebody's got to loan it into existence again.
Yeah, they're using it for something that... interesting, the only bank I know, and I know the Co-op, we're talking in the UK, the Co-op is quoted as an ethical bank. But the only bank I've come across, and I'm not saying it is the only one, but the only one I know, that tells you who it's lending its money to and lists all the debtors that it's lending to is Triodos Bank.
Yes, I've heard very good things about them. The guys I know that are really at the bleeding edge of permaculture and establishing communities in the UK, they do their banking with Triodos.
So we're not.
So there's one thing we could do, isn't it?
Yeah.
If they're the only one.
We could give a plug for Triodos.
Yeah.
And we could throw out a challenge for any other bank or fledgling bank or emerging bank who wants to be considered to put themselves up there as being completely transparent as to where they lend out our money and on what terms. Because we want to know. We want to be responsible for what our money or our promissory notes do in the world in the time between us issuing them and needing to bring them back in.
So we're making our money more accountable by putting it in something like the Triodos Bank. And am I right in saying that apart from the Triodos Bank, who have maintained their value during the current troubles, that the other group of entities that have also maintained their value are the few mutual building societies that are left?
Right.
Now, obviously, unfortunately, they've still got their money with a high street bank.
Yes.
But it still means that you are making, as well as putting your money somewhere, you're making a kind of moral statement, you're setting an intent to remove your money from the banking system, with which, in all honesty, after what they've done, none of us should really, we should all be considering just leaving, should we not?
Yes.
So changing banks to the Triodos, and at any rate trying to abandon the people who are robbing us, because why stay? If you had another primary recommendation for your own kind of resolution to this, what would it be?
It would be to... your money effectively represents your will, where you want to put your personal energy. You have to think about that, because how you express yourself in the world has consequences. So think through the consequences. Because if you believe that there is a divine order, or however you want to describe it, but a universal system that keeps the books, then you don't be racking up debts for your moral, debts for your eternal soul in the future, which you cannot pay back. You want to have a clean account. So even at the most fundamental level of when you go in and buy something, well, what's the story behind how this was made? Who made it? Was it made locally? Was it made by, I know it's cheap, but was it made by kids pretty much under house arrest in a factory in some part of the Far East, you know? Am I benefiting from human misery when I buy this product? What was the effect on the environment? And we should also ask exactly the same questions when we give our money to keep it in safekeeping to somebody else, i.e. a bank. We should say, so what are you going to do with this money? You know, what you get, when I give it to you, what happens to it? What do you do with it? Do you put it on the overnight market? Do you invest it in a few arms companies, etc., etc.? Is this going to nuclear fuel? Does this go to sort of keep some wide boys in the city solvent so they can carry on buying up our land?
Yeah. Well, that's, so what we're saying, and this I think is a really nice place to resolve this conversation, is because what we're saying is we can take the same meaningless promissory notes that we've got at the moment, and by changing our intent, by changing the people to whom we give these meaningless promissory notes, and then by trying to circulate them amongst ourselves, we will actually change the way our world will manifest. And we don't, until the currency changes, until we get a no-interest currency, or until bigger changes manifest, that this will start making a change.
Absolutely.
Just doing that.
Absolutely. This is about reform. This is not about revolution, although it's profoundly revolutionary. But here we go with the paradox. And there is the resolution of the paradox. And I want to say this for any members of the current establishment that may be listening, that this is actually not about putting you guys out of business. This is about saving your necks. Because if you have a population who are basically content with their lot, I don't give a shit how many yachts you drive around the Pacific or how big your entourage is. Good luck. If that's what you need, have it. But if you're going to keep that, without having to go to war with the human population itself, witness what's happening in Syria at the moment, turning on its own population, witness what's happening in Lebanon, etc. How long before that happens in Europe? If you don't want that situation, you just let people be creative and recreate their own lives and their own economies. Don't get in the way. You don't get in the way of us, we won't get in the way of you. We want to deliver your big society.
Yeah, exactly right.
But guess what? It's our big society too.
Yeah, brilliant. Well said indeed. And perhaps they should bear in mind the words of that French philosopher, I can't remember which one it was, who said that there are three main aspects to folly, which are, you know, the perpetuation of self-aggrandizement, i.e. constantly feeding yourself at the expense of the system, the failure to recognize the disassociation of constituents, and the illusion of invulnerable status. Those are the three prime aspects of folly, and all of them, I think, are perfectly characterised by the situation we've been talking about. And you're quite right. If they don't want the populace at their throats, things need to change.
Yeah. So we want to help.
Brilliant. We want to help. Fantastic. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Absolutely excellent.
Thanks, Nick.
And I think go out pretty much uncut. That can really done a great job, Tom.
Hello, you're back with Dr. Rock's radio show here on tnsradio.com. And it looks like you can all hear me out there, which is great. TNS, by the way, stands for TNSR, for those of you who might be new to the programme. That's Land of the Free, and the servers are based over there in Southern Ireland. Well, for those of you who managed to follow us from the fast player to the slow player, we were listening earlier on to Mike the Money Man, who was talking to us about the nature of money and the nature of the economy a bit that we live in. And he took us back right at the beginning to a point at which all of our weights and measures were kind of directly related to the things that we were dealing with. And I spoke about a set of bells that they had in China which would measure a dry volume, so a volume of sand, say, or a liquid volume, a volume of water. And these were related to each other in the same bell, and the bell would have a given pitch and a given weight as well. So what we had was, or what they had was, a complete set of weight and measures that were actually echoes of the, if you like, the divine proportion, the geometry of the world in which we found ourselves. And really, I guess that in those days we'd have been pretty well tuned into our world. And it seems to me that once we started moving our weights and measures away from that kind of accuracy, then we started moving away from the true knowledge of the world in which we live. And most of the people listening to me now know how far that movement has now gone. We seem to be a long, long way away from the real world that we were born into. He also talked about a period in which there was no tax, no income tax. Now, I think many people will probably find that quite difficult to imagine. We've so much taken it on board that our income, our effort, if you like, our actual input into the system should be taxed. And it has not always been the case. People did used to kind of come down on you and try and get money out of you for soldiers and things like that, but the regular taxing of your income, if you like, the governing of what it is that you're doing by the removal of some of the stuff that you earn as a result, is a relatively new idea. He touched on a metaphor for a frog in a pot, which I don't think we necessarily made quite clear, and I'm aware that not everybody's heard of it. I gather the basic idea behind it is that if you put a frog in some water because you want to cook it and have its legs away, or for whatever reason, then slowly increasing the heat in the pan will, the frog won't notice it happening, so it will stay in there until it dies and you can eat its legs or whatever you're going to do. Whereas if you try to chuck it into a boiling pot, it will jump out, apparently. So his point was there that, slowly but surely you change things. Things are changed bit by bit around us so that maybe we don't notice too much, because otherwise we're going to object to what's happening to us and we're going to try to, you know, evade it or whatever. And by the time we got to the end of the talk, we'd concluded that, of course, we are now at that stage. We are at the point where we really do need to get out of the pot, where we've actually noticed, a lot of us, that things are really not as they should be. The other things that Mike brought up was this idea of an objective debate. We live in a society which is based on the idea of opposition. You know, we have opposition parties that sit a sword's length away from each other in the Houses of Parliament, and most of the things we do are in some way competitive. And as a result, we like to, on our standard radio chats and things like that, when we see things on the television, there's quite often the idea that there is some kind of debate going on, that there's a genuine weighing up, if you like, somehow, of one side of an argument and another side of the argument in this polarized world in which we live. But I think you become aware, as Mike pointed out pretty quickly, that we're not really dealing in any sense with an actual opposition in these debates. So we might have somebody from the left and the right, and if they're feeling generous, maybe somebody from the centre as well, and we might hear these things being debated. But I know that personally, at no stage, or very, very rarely, do I ever hear the kind of ideas that we're talking about ever coming up in these debates. And of course, we're now aware, are we not, those of us that are down the rabbit hole, or on the other side of, become aware that we're living on the other side of the looking glass, we're aware that in fact there is the whole other side of the debate appears to be missing. And yet, there is still this impression that there's debate going on. It's quite amazing, really. And of course, whilst the large proportion of the population remain as asleep, effectively, completely unaware of the administrative state that is being exercised around them, there's not going to be a chance for genuine debate, which is what makes things like TNS radio so exciting, because you can actually hear things being discussed which are otherwise just not necessarily available to you, maybe even deliberately hidden, who knows. So money and the banks, this idea that they're taking our goodwill effectively and storing it to themselves. I mentioned briefly in passing a couple of times probably Mike Montagna's ideas, and he's familiar to the people on TNS Radio, I'm sure, because he has a regular program with us. And he's devised and demonstrated for a long, long time the idea of a mathematically perfected economy, which does not result in this kind of false money and having all of our effort effectively collateralized and stolen from us. In fact, I'd say that the arrival of Mike Montagna, an apparently sane economist, shows that the end must surely be nigh, because up till now it seems to me that every single economist I've listened to has been really quite crazy, quite and basically crazy. But one of the problems we have is usury. One way we can see usury is the fact that people are charging interest on money. That means that people are actually making money from money, whereas money should be a representation of our own promises to each other. So that's one way of looking at usury, is the addition of interest. As Mike Montagna points out, even if you have 0.5% of interest over the kind of timescales that we're talking, eventually your economy will collapse. And we've obviously, I remember times when we've had interest rates of 17%, so we must have been building it pretty quickly in those times. But that's not the only usury we're suffering. It turns out that that when you borrow money off a bank, your debt becomes their asset. They do a thing called securitization, where they will take the £1,000 that they've nominally lent you, and they will sell that. They will securitize the piece of paper, turn it into a security, and they will sell it for maybe £1,500, £1,600, £1,700 or whatever. So right from the word go, they've made a £600 or £700 profit on you or whoever it is that borrows the money, without a penny ever being paid back. So people are making money on money in quite a big way. It's not just by the 0.5% or even the horrendous idea of 17% interest. It is by literally taking your debt, taking our debt, taking people's need to add currency to the market and to bring effort to the marketplace, and turning it into an asset which is then bought and sold with, the originator never seeing any of that benefit at all. And although I have a bit of a grasp of economics, I must admit I was personally quite surprised to see that it is that blatant. That, of course, I got off Daryl's fantastic program that he did recently. He did I think it's available as a podcast, an amazing meeting. I think it was called the Monaghan Event, and I think he must have been going for 5 or 6 hours. The podcast's about 4 hours long, but it really brings into close focus things like this business of usury, of how our effort's being stolen from us. Another thing that Mike mentioned in passing was the fact that people can nowadays get away with saying things and doing things which maybe 20, 30 years ago would have required their resignation, you know, from office. Because when you take an oath of office, when you take on the mantle of endeavouring to represent other people, it's not unreasonable to expect people to be trying at least to set some sort of example, whatever that means. But it is quite clear now that to a great extent in public life, people appear to be able to do things and not have to step down from public office in order to sort it out. I don't know that whether all of you have seen the list of potential kind of malfeasances and misbehaviours and things that appear to have gone on amongst many of the members of the Houses of Commons, but there is an email around the place which points out that some 42% of them have had some interest in, writing bad checks or fraud or abuse of their partners or assault or what have you. I mean, I know it comes to all of us at times, but the thing is, are we all standing up there and trying to make hundreds and hundreds or thousands of laws on a daily basis? So that's changed as well, you know, because people did used to resign when they felt that it was necessary without actually even having to be pushed, and nowadays it seems that people don't even necessarily get pushed. But the main point of the whole thing, I think, is the money creation. It's so simple, as one of his quotes said, that the mind is repelled, that people can, that money can be borrowed and then sold like that, and debt becomes credit. And we wondered what the solutions might be to some of these things, how we might, you know, down here at our level deal with it, because Mike Montagna says, I think quite correctly, that, you know, we're down to more or less 0% interest rates, which can only mean that we're well past the point of collapse, and that, you know, a great wave of difficulty is coming to us in that way. But our cash, if you like, the money that we're using, the actual, the sort of notes, the bits of paper, I know they're meaningless promissory notes and all of that, but as tokens of our good faith to each other, and as in Vin's story of the $100 coming into town and passing through and paying off a load of debts and then leaving again, it can be regarded as a sort of useful thing for us, and we can make it a little bit, you know, maybe improve our use of it by not letting it get back into a bank. I'm becoming more certain since I had that chat with Mike that once you put your cash back in a bank, somebody's got to borrow it out of there again, and that it's not going to come out again otherwise. So, and plus the fact we can see that by moving these meaningless promissory notes amongst ourselves and not letting them escape from our community, they can in some sense still do the job that money was for, which was, you know, as somebody said, to enable you to make something of the difference between a cow and a teacup, say, in terms of your purchases. So another thing that's important to take into account, I think, and this was just touched on, is the idea that all systems have a degree of ebb and flow, of expansion and contraction. And one of the things that we've certainly seen in the time that I've been on the planet this time around is a drive persistently to expand economies, persistently to expand everything, in fact. I mean, a small company might set itself up, I don't know, making a particularly nice foodstuff, say, I don't know, pickles or something, and it might be really good at it with the people that it's got in the place that it's doing it. And its product itself, of course, might be dependent on the area from which it comes, on where the fruits come from, on where the water comes from, lots and lots of things. But what tends inevitably to happen is that a small and effective company like that will get bigger. If it's successful, it will get bigger and it will get bigger, and then it will get bought, and then it will no longer be the thing that it was. And the drive to make things bigger, it seems to me, is so embedded that it is actually very, very hard to make something good and small and keep it good and small. But that's one of the things that I think, as a result, I think that we need to be concentrating on. If we can make small functional units that work underneath or within the big and incomprehensible thing that we find ourselves dealing with, and if those small units can work with each other, then we're more likely to get a decent result, especially if we realise that things are going to go, you know, there will be the ebb and flow. We'll have little runs forward, and then we'll have periods when we have to wait and think a little. As Amit Goswami says, his motto is dooby dooby doo, which means he recognises that every time you do something, it takes something out of your system that you then need to be for a while before you can do again. It's, if you like, the kind of cycle of inspiration. Obviously, Mike Montagna's idea that money is eventually retired, so that if money's brought into the system to pay for something, then when that something is no longer there or when it has been used up, then the money that represents it in the system also has to be treated as if it's used up and it has to be removed. And obviously that's a really great thing, and that, I think Mike put that really well. He said imagine if money could die. And one of the things we face is the immortality of money as opposed to the mortality of the human beings. Immortality of corporations as opposed to the mortality of human beings. It's a very sensitive and sensitively made point, I thought. So, our intent, where we put our money, that's really important. Who we spend it with, who we give it to, how we get it even to a certain extent. And, you know, if a slightly more open attitude to money and things, it's quite easy, and I know a lot of us are already doing it, for us to swap skills and items and time and things for other people's skills and items and time, which, of course, also spreads the few meaningless promissory notes that we lay our hands on, makes them spread a little bit further. The banks. Everybody's still got a bank account. We don't appear to have managed to do anything at all apart from further dig ourselves into the huge hole that has been already been dug for us on that one. I'm wondering, I know that the British Constitution Group are trying to come up with an interest-free currency, but I'm wondering if anybody's coming up with a bank that we can actually use. I know there was some very interesting stuff running through the chat box whilst we were talking about the Triodos Bank. There was a lot of stuff in there about the Co-op Bank. But obviously, we did put out a plea, you know, to any small banks that stand a chance of surviving. It would be great to see things run on something of a different principle. And the other thing is our will, where we put our will. It's not a wish, it's our will. And where we set our intent, that is the way things go. When we're taught to ride pedal cycles or motorcycles, I think it's quite so true for cars, we're taught that if there's some sort of accident in front of you, then you need to look away from the accident because your body, the motorcycle or the bicycle or whatever it is, will go where your eyes are looking. So we get fascinated by that sort of thing. Where we put our will is absolutely crucial in all of this. And we now have lots of things available to us. Those are a few thoughts really on Mike's chat. I'm going to play a couple of tunes, and then I've got an interview or a discussion that I had with the Spaniard, who is a character who works with a group called the White Rabbit Education Group. And you can imagine, all of you Matrix watchers, what that is. Follow the White Rabbit. It's an information stream that's very interesting. And the Spaniard was, for a good long time, I think he says 16 or 17 years, he was a retail banker and a mortgage broker. And because we have to do the sort of things that we have to do occasionally, he had to go out and collect the debts as well when people weren't doing what was believed, deemed to be required of them. And then, really quite suddenly, I think he realised, like a lot of us do, sort of poked his head out into the light and realised that somehow the whole thing was not as it had been put across. So he's a man who knows what the inside of a bank and the mortgage brokers and all this, he knows what all the instruments are, and this makes him a very, very interesting person to listen to. I personally really enjoyed my time with him, and I'm thoroughly looking forward to seeing him again. In fact,